If you enjoy podcasts like this, you should check out our other shows on Health Podcast Network. For example, Better with Dr. Erica, hosted by Dr. Erica, provides support and guidance in navigating stress-related challenges to transform your relationship to self-care. Each episode arms you with the tools needed to be better, do better, and live better. There was an incredible episode that you should check out called Touch and Connections as Tools for Healing and Better Mental Health. In this episode, her guest breaks down ways to use physical touch as a form of healing for trauma and grief. Check out Better with Dr. Erica on your favorite podcast platform or visit healthpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the On the Road to the Gambia podcast, where we are bridging boundaries for global health equity. I am Dr. Carol Penn, doubly board certified in family medicine and obesity medicine. I am a best-selling author and a master meditation, movement, and mindset coach, serving as the director of Tracks and Electives, assistant professor of family medicine at our nation's newest medical school, Rocky Vista University, Montana College of Osteopathic Medicine. I am the proud co-founder of the Institute for Community Evolution. Together with Sunu Ryu, the University of the Gambia, Penn Global Visions, and the Edward Francis Smalls Teaching Hospital, we are fostering a new era of global healthcare collaboration. I'm excited to bring you the amazing stories of 15 clinicians from the U.S. who will travel to the Gambia and exchange cutting-edge knowledge with Gambian medical professionals to uplift communities and empower each other to become compassionate and culturally sensitive healthcare leaders on both sides of the Atlantic. So put on your headphones and listen as we explore this transformative journey to the Gambia.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of On the Road to Gambia, the podcast. So I'm your host, Dr. Lisa Herbert, a board-certified family physician, best-selling author, speaker, and executive leadership coach. And I help physicians transition into leadership roles so that they can become the respective voices in healthcare. So I'm excited to be back again today with another amazing guest. So as you know, this podcast is highlighting 15 U.S. clinicians who are embarking on a transformative journey with the Institute for Community Evolution, SUNY Ru, University of Gambia, Penn Global Visions, and the Edward Francis Small Teaching Hospital to foster a new era of global healthcare collaboration. So on our podcast today, I have with me Dr. Anila Ricks-Ford. And Dr. Anila is a board-certified OBGYN with a bachelor's in biology, a minor in psychology, and a doctor of medicine. She is a dedicated wife, married for more than 20 years, a mother to three beautiful and intelligent children, who values her time with her family as much as she does her career. Dr. Anila has studied at Indiana University, Johns Hopkins University, and Howard University College of Medicine. Her expertise, compassion, and approachable demeanor make her a well-sought-after women's health advocate, educator, and speaker. It's easy to observe all of the successes in Dr. Anila's life and career, but she is also transparent about her failures, setting them as soul food for her personal and professional growth. It is the totality of her life experiences that Dr. Anila attributes to making her a more thoughtful, considerate, and compassionate person and physician. In her current role as an OBGYN hospitalist, she is focused on infant and maternal mortality. She helps women find their voice and become empowered by providing them with holistic care, a safe space, and exceptional medical care. So welcome to the On the Road to Gambia podcast, Dr. Anila. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so very much, Dr. Lisa. It's so lovely to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yes, so I can't wait to get into some questions with you and for you to just kind of tell our audience a little bit about your journey and your experience being an OBGYN. So first, let's just start off, you know, looking at your career and your leadership journey. Who or what might have been instrumental in that decision?
Honestly, my mother. So I have always wanted to be a scientist ever since I was a little girl. And contemplated medicine and then thought that the time frame to do it would be too long. So contemplated nursing and then My mother had an untimely death, actually, and it was what fueled me to go into medicine. Unfortunately, as is common, particularly for that time frame. So my mother's been gone now for 30 years, but she had limited access to the system. And as a consequence of limited access to the system, unfortunately was misdiagnosed and informed to follow up with her physician the next day. And she never lived to follow up with her physician the next day. My mother was diagnosed with the flu and told to follow up with her physician. And she actually had septicemia, which is a completely different thing. And so it's fueled how I see people. I'm an OBGYN because I didn't ever want anyone else to have the loss or know the loss that I felt with having lost their mother, their sister, their aunt, their grandmother. And so my practice of obstetrics and gynecology is actually cathartic in that because I couldn't save my mom, I'll be damned if I don't save the people that come across my path when I'm responsible for them. You know, and so my mother is huge. Had that not happened, I might've just been a bench scientist because I was a bench scientist before I went to medical school. I tried really hard not to go to medical school, but it didn't work so well. So
yes, yes. Thank you for sharing that story. And I think that I certainly can, you know, appreciate where that drive comes from, especially when we are faced with that sort of a loss, right? When someone close to us, you know, experiences that limit or lack of access to healthcare. And unfortunately, we're still seeing that happen today.
Yes, ma'am.
Which I think is, you know, part of the reason why we're all kind of on this crusade and, you know, why we do the things that we do. So in your current role, you know, as an OBGYN hospitalist, sort of what does that look like? You know, what do you do on a day-to-day? Who do you serve? What challenges do you face? And ultimately, you know, what are you hoping to achieve in this role?
Sure. So in my current role, I'm actually the equivalent of an OBGYN emergency room physician for women. Anyone who has gynecologic issues where you're trying to have an early lunch date with Jesus because you want to bleed all your blood volume out of your personal space, or ladies who have, essentially I triage all, but I'm primarily responsible for people who do not have a physician. I take care of people who are the underserved, essentially, for gynecologic issues and for obstetrical issues. And so, I'm sorry, you asked me who do I serve and what was the other question? I'm sorry.
Okay, what challenges do you face? You know, what are the things that you're seeing? Yeah.
Yes. So unfortunately, I'm currently in Texas and I practice in Corpus Christi. And what I see there is a preponderance of, and also actually in Washington State. And what I see there is a preponderance of people who just are unaware of the role that their lifestyle choices play in their health conditions. It is quite saddening on a regular basis. And so I work 24-hour shifts. I'm responsible for caring for those who cross my path for 24 hours and then someone else comes in and leaves me behind. But you see, over and over and over and over again, women who have hypertension in pregnancy, women who have diabetes in pregnancy, either pre-existing or only secondary to pregnancy, or both, or chronic hypertension or severe preeclampsia. And the thing that is that I try to make a difference, or the area that I try to make a difference in, is helping them understand how small changes in lifestyle and diet can change the outcomes of their pregnancies and decrease pregnancy complications. The disheartening thing is how many of our patients, or at least how many of the patients that I care for, just don't know any better. That the food choices that you make, that the supplements that you take, that whether or not you just exercise 5 out of 7 days a week, 30 minutes of brisk walking is enough. They just don't recognize the intensity or the severity of what can happen in pregnancy. I think, unfortunately, because our society sees it as just a change in state or just a condition and it's really no big deal, your body reconstructs itself in order to make another human being. If you look at it from that standpoint, oh my God, that takes a lot of energy and effort. Like even at the level of your breasts, when you talk about, so old school, there used to be a commercial, be all that you can be, get an edge on life in the army. Your boobs don't become what they're supposed to become or what they truly can become until you get pregnant and try and have a baby. They undergo massive reconstruction in order to feed a human being. Other than that, they're just lying dormant, you know, waiting to get the call in order to do stuff. And so if your boobs reroute themselves, if your bones break down in order to say, oh, hey, let me get a straw, stick it inside there, and let the baby just, in order to get all of its calcium, like, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
You have twice as much blood volume. People don't understand the stress on your heart and your kidneys and your lungs and what it takes energetically, emotionally, spiritually, to create another person and then successfully bring forth right life, and then you not suffer consequences as a consequence, that you rebound in 18 months from the experience that you had. We just don't understand that. And so in the small doses that I'm able to, because oddly enough, I thought I wouldn't be able to practice continuity of care this way, but there are quite a few people that use us as their OBGYN, and they see us regularly for visits, which is not ideal, but if this is how you access the system, okay, fine. But you're able to do small things like check a vitamin D level and put them on vitamin D when they're too low, particularly in Black and brown women, because we have a tendency to be low, and low vitamin D is correlated with preeclampsia, increased risk for preeclampsia, or looking to make sure they're not anemic, because if you have a hemoglobin, a hematocrit of less than 30 at 10 and 32, if you're 10 and 30, 30, ADHD. If you're 10 and 30 at 30 weeks, you have an increased likelihood of autism spectrum disorder by 12%. And so every anemic that I see, if you come in, particularly if you complain of dehydration, girl, you got a couple hours, let me hook you up with some IV iron in order to be able to make it. So A, you don't get preeclampsia, and B, your human is not in the special classes because it's having a hard time functioning in the grand scheme of things. Like small things like that. Pregnant women typically, and I will be the first to admit, my last child is 14 years old. I have a 22 on the cusp of 23, a 17-year-old, and a 14-year-old now. I still have iron downstairs that I was prescribed after that last child was born, because the oral iron, sometimes it's well tolerated, usually it's not. And then if things cause you to have issues with how you flow, why are you going to be compliant? If it upsets your stomach and it gives you some, and it changes your activities of daily living, why would you even? So if there's another way to be able to get people to be safe, that's what I do. I see opportunities to be able to impart tiny bits of wisdom in the people who are unaware. And hopefully over the long course, it changes the course of their pregnancy or the health of their pregnancy or the health of their offspring.
Absolutely. And I love that, because I was going to ask you that question. I'm like, well, how do you make a change? And you're just seeing someone usually like within a 24-hour period, right? And it's not...
We talk. The beautiful thing about being a hospitalist is I got all the time in the world. I'm there for 24 hours. Where am I going? Nowhere. Good, great.
But even that small dose of inspiration, or that, you know, finite amount of time that you have with them, I'm sure leads to, you know, big changes down the line. Yeah,
that is
definitely.
The hope. That is the hope.
Yeah. So you are definitely filling a gap, right? And hopefully bridging, which it sounds like you are, bridging a gap between those people who don't have access to healthcare and really need a safe space and need competent, you know, compassionate care for delivering their children, and you're providing that. So looking at sort of what you're doing now, and then thinking about this trip that we're going on to the Gambia, what inspired you to kind of volunteer your time and expertise to this continent and to the physicians and the people there?
It was an opportunity to give back. I am keenly devoted. I care for all people, but I am committed to making a difference in the lives of Black and brown people. And the trick is, medicine is an art as much as it is a science. And I think, unfortunately, loosely speaking, particularly with my branch of medicine, we have a tendency to look at it more from the science perspective and not necessarily from the art perspective. What I've been able to glean over the years, and I'm exceptionally grateful for the training that I received, because clearly it is foundational to who I am, particularly from Howard University College of Medicine, which is all about service. Yes. And the where I trained at WellSpan York Health. But over the years, for the last few years, I've been honing my craft. For me, it is more of an intuitive thing. Anybody can perform a C-section. Anybody can, well, in theory, deliver a human out of somebody's personal space. But it is really about listening to what the patient is telling you and what her baby is telling you. Because if you listen, you can kind of hear and adjust your care so that it is individualized to meet the needs of the person that you're taking care of. In this country, the rate of morbidity and mortality has been on the rise. It was 32.8 at last check, 32.8 maternal deaths per 100,000 live births. In the Gambia, it's 300. If I could go and just take some of the stuff that I've learned and infuse or instill that in somebody else, because I think, again, the problem is medicine is not so much intuitive. And I think obstetrics and gynecology is what you see and what they say to you and what they don't say in order for you to be able to make it so you can make a difference for the people that you're charged to serve. And so my hope is to be able to see where I can fit into decreasing this number from 300 per 100,000 to getting it to be however low it can get to be by taking the pearls that I've gleaned and sharing them with somebody else, and learning stuff in the interim too, seeing whatever their need is and inserting myself however I can, wherever I can, in order to make a difference.
Absolutely. And those numbers are staggering. I mean, just to hear you say it is, wow, it's concerning. You know, even 32% even 32% here is too much.
Yes,
so we have a lot of work to do. And I'm so grateful that, you know, you and other of the clinicians that are going to be able to just bring the expertise there to kind of address some of the same issues that we have here. you know, just on
Yes,
a different
ma'am.
scale, but they're definitely some of the same issues. So, you know, thinking about going to the Gambia, what is your perception and awareness of the medical care challenges there? You know, you already talked about the high mortality rate, infant mortality rate, infant maternal, excuse me, mortality rate. What about, what are you aware of, you know, as some of the challenges that you may face going on this medical mission trip?
So I've had different perspectives. It's my understanding that for a good bit, it's access and it's tools. And so what I've been trying to do, for example, when you mentioned, there was an article that I read not too long ago that talked about the state of healthcare in Gambia, and specifically from a maternal medicine standpoint, what issues did they have? And there was an article that I read that I think referenced a woman who died in 2019 when she bled to death after having had a baby. And so there are tools here that we have that are standard. We have literally a hemorrhage kit that has got different meds in it in order to be able to cause the uterus to contract or decrease or cause platelets to work a little bit differently. There are tools that you can actually insert inside the uterus in order to tamponade against it, some that put suction on. What I've actually been doing is trying to recruit from the places that I work inspired devices in order to be able to take them with me in order to help however I can.
Yeah.
But the thought is, again, I'm open to, I need to see for myself what challenges or obstacles are there and then figure out how we can because in a limited resource area, make changes that will allow them to be able to not necessarily comply, but so if you think about the tools that we have here, there's some tools that we have here that have no practical application there. Like there's a device called a Jada that actually puts suction on the uterus, but it requires that you have to have wall suction plus minus perpetual electricity. There's actually the company who makes this device that is that causes the uterus to firm up. It's actually making a global product now that you can actually use with a hand pump that I just found out because I was talking to the rep about getting supplies and this is what she told me. So it's figuring out what are the causative factors for the maternal mortality rate there, and then figuring out how we can develop a plan or a strategy based on where you are and what you have access to in order to be able to make a difference.
Hey, leading ladies, stay right there and we will be back with my amazing guests. This conversation is so good that you don't want to miss it. So stay tuned.
Absolutely.
I had the pleasure of years ago. So the last 6 weeks of my medical school experience were actually spent in South Africa on a family health rotation. And what I saw there was, here in the States, you come to the emergency room, everybody and their mama gets a CT just because that's what you do. And to be able to practice medicine clinically, to be able to put your hands on somebody, to listen to what it is their body is telling you, and then respond accordingly, that's whatever the challenges are, I will submerge myself in the environment, see what they are, and figure out how we can come up with a plan or a strategy based on where we are and what resources we have in order to take what I know here and apply it there.
Yeah. And I love how you say that, because it's really, when we think about it, getting back to the foundation, right, of medicine. And how I know I was trained as well. I remember working with a family physician in my internship year, and he basically took me into his clinic and he said, just be quiet. The patient will tell you in the first 10 or 15 minutes what's wrong with them. And your exam and all the other stuff you do is just confirmative, right? So
yes, ma'am.
It's really just getting back to that foundation of medicine. And like you said, using the art of medicine and then
yes, ma'am.
Adding on, you know, everything else, all the tools that we have and
yes,
and the fancy equipment
yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Right. And like you said, you know, so in your training, I know that it's challenging and there can be times where it's very scary. You make, you know, life or death decisions, you know, you have to make them pretty quickly. And there are times when things are just unexpected, right? Things just kind of happen. So if you think back in your career about a time possibly when there was a sudden change or unexpected condition, how did you adjust to that? And then what did that do in terms of how you continue to practice, or how did that impact your personal or professional life?
Through the years, there have been multiple. As you mentioned, obstetrics is usually happy, but sometimes it's not. Sometimes babies die, sometimes mamas die. By the grace of God, I have as yet, knocking on wood, as yet to lose a mama or a baby that was mine and my charge. I've had, in the years that I've been delivering babies, I have had one that I was called in to rescue that was someone else's child that was already 12 minutes in trouble before I got there. And so it was an exercise in futility. I would do it all over again, but it was an exercise in futility. And I think recognizing boundaries, I think in this job, particularly if you're a person who is empathetic, you can be out of balance and take on more than what is yours. And over the years, I have done that. And so what I recognize is, as we mentioned earlier, in the role that I play, I am a shepherd. My whole goal is to keep you safe. If you cross my path, you cross my path for a reason. And so once I can hear what it is you're telling me and what it is you're not telling me to figure out what it is you need and how I can serve you, I do that. Specifically as it relates to pregnant women. And pregnant women, I love them, but they are a shady group. They can be good in one minute and not in the next, like, and have a, try to have early
life. Maybe it's the hormones.
Like that. Yeah. Well, no, not necessarily that. I'm saying they can be fine. And all of a sudden you got blood pressure
yes.
220
oh, yes.
over 112.
Right.
Or
right,
you can
right.
be fine. And then all of a sudden you're trying to bleed all your blood volume out of your
uterus.
And it's like, what, Jesus? Two creams, one sugar, and a blueberry scone, please. No conversations with Jesus on my watch, please. And thank you. When I say shade, I mean that. You don't turn your back on them because they can look good in 1 minute and not in the next.
Right.
Exactly. And so in that instance, I'm a servant and I listen to what it is that they tell me. And I intuitively listen and use discernment for what it is I'm supposed to do for them. Mm-hmm. And I recognize that as long as I stay in that lane and I listen, as a general rule, things have been okay. But boundaries have been crucial for me from the standpoint of taking on more than what was mine. For example, I had a lady. So I live in El Paso and I used to practice medicine. Ooh, kind of shaky, apologize. I used to practice medicine in El Paso until a year ago. 20 to 2023 until a year ago, there was a woman. So here in El Paso, we have immigrants that come across the border, and there are different waves. People that come from South America, Central America. There are people that come from even Haiti. And so I had a woman in May of 2022. I had a Haitian immigrant who came in who had severe blood pressures. When I talked to you about that 220 over 112, that was her. She only spoke Haitian Creole. And as a consequence, getting an interpreter was a big deal because you can get someone who speaks French, but it's not exactly the same.
Right.
She came in accompanied by Border Patrol. They say she's one gestational age. She gives you a date that's another gestational age. And her belly tells you she's somewhere in between the two. Now, with a lady who's got a blood pressure that's 220 over 112, your first goal is to get her pressures under control for sure. But the question is, if you have to deliver her, when are you delivering her? And based on how pregnant she is, how long do you sit on her versus not? When do you pull the plug? And so long story short, this woman ends up having an exceptionally complicated health course. And so she turns out when you finally get the right interpreter on the third try using the electronic system, it turns out she was apprehended by Border Patrol. She actually broke her water, and all the stuff I'm telling you is absolutely okay that I tell you because she's completely cool with me telling you. So I'm not violating anybody's HIPAA. So she broke her water. And then by the time I figured, so now she's a preeclamptic and she's broken her water and she's somewhere around 32 weeks. And so she's premature. And so how long do I sit on her to try and get steroid effect in order to make a difference for her child? But how long do I wait before her organs start having all kinds of issues and she goes into dysfunction and you know, massive disease before we get into trouble? So this lady, her body actually told me I didn't have to wait long because unfortunately she erupted because her pressures were high. So her placenta pulled away from the wall of the uterus. The baby told me before the mama did because it was doing these little dippity doodads and she would contract and the heart rate would dip. We ended up doing a stat C-section on this lady. And because she had previously had a C-section, just one in another country in Brazil, she had extensive adhesive disease. This woman delivers this baby. His name is Brian. Brian comes out looking like this. And for a Haitian baby to look like that, it's a problem. So Brian comes out looking like that.
Gosh.
He ends up, it's the first time I've ever had a baby that had four Apgars. I didn't even know that was such a thing. He had four Apgars. His mother ends up, we end up closing her. She has some oozing. I think that she's going to be okay. She goes to the PACU. Because I work 24-hour shifts now, I'm done. I leave. I go someplace else to work. I come back in a week and they tell me, your lady has had some health complications since you left. So she went into kidney failure because of her preeclampsia.
Yeah.
She ended up on postoperative day number five, she went into DIC and she ended up bleeding into her abdomen. She lost her uterus. On postoperative day number five, she had that done. On postoperative day number six, she had a hysterectomy. On postoperative day number six, they had to go back and pack her with packing because she was oozing from all the surfaces because she was in DIC. On postoperative day number 7, they ended up taking out the stuff and putting on a wound vac. And then she ended up in the hospital. Long story short, this woman ended up in the hospital for 54 days because she had kidney failure, and then she had infections, and then she finally turned the corner. But because she was in the ICU for friggin' ever, she had to rehab once she finally got out, and then went to the floor. And I agonized. And by the grace of God, because babies, neuroelasticity is a lovely thing. Brian's brain was just fine. Hashtag yay. Hashtag win. But I blamed myself for, if I had moved faster, if I had recognized what was going on sooner, if it hadn't taken me so long to get an interpreter who spoke her language, then maybe things would have been different for her. And what my colleagues told me was, had you not taken care of her, she would have died. Mm-hmm. And what she told me later on, right before she ended up leaving, and this is the awesome thing, she healed her own kidneys and didn't have to be on dialysis. She was on multiple antihypertensives, but she healed her own kidneys before she left. She left on the 14th of July, 2022 from the hospital, and I left on the 15th, never to go back ever again, because that PTSD was real. But what she told me was, when she had her pastor came from a church, there's a Haitian pastor in town, and he came and he spoke as interpreter, and she felt more comfortable using him than the language line. And what she told me was two things. She said to me, thank you for taking care of me like my mother, even though I know you're not my mother. Thank you for taking care of me like my mother would have. And there was a time when I came to see her after I came back, and she was in the ICU and she was intubated and sedated. And they told me, you know, she's not responsive. And I touched her when she was in the ICU and she turned her head and she looked at me. And I thought, well, girl, they said you was intubated and sedated, but you ain't that gone. What she told me was that she knew I was there. She felt me and she felt the presence of God. Mm. That thing, I am a servant. I go where I'm called and I do what it is I'm supposed to do. And I serve those that I'm supposed to serve. But that thing had me questioning who I was as a person and whether or not I did right for her. And I recognized that in that instance, maybe it didn't go the way I thought it should have gone, but she lived and her child lived. And and it was because of my efforts that she lived and her child lived. So that's the biggie in recognizing, not that I think I'm God by any means, but when you're dedicated to who you serve and you're dedicated to making it so at the end of the day, you can sleep at night knowing you did right by them, you sometimes question whether or not you did all that you could do. And in that instance, because I'm an empathic person, I felt like I had done her harm and like I did something wrong to her. And it was actually the opposite. And she didn't feel that way. And neither did any of the other people involved in her care. So I hope that answered the question.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, Dr. Anila, thank you for sharing that story. I just can't imagine being in your shoes at that, you know, during that particular time. But I'm sure it was, you know, like to the question, impactful, obviously.
Yes.
And just reveals so much to you of not only who you are as a person, but your calling.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. And again, if we come full circle, it's about people who don't have access and looking out for them and keeping them safe. And if she wasn't my mother, come full circle, I don't even know what it was from the standpoint of being her advocate. Like, it got to the point where, unfortunately, because she speaks Haitian Creole and everybody here speaks Spanish, they assumed that there's crossover. And so they were just not really speaking to her in Haitian Creole. And so cultural differences, she doesn't eat the food. It turns out she was primarily a plant-based person. The foods that they were feeding her, her rehab was kind of on the decline because she wasn't eating the foods that they were giving her because nobody asked her what she was going to eat. And so literally it got to the point where on the days that I worked with, she was in, I was like, girl, we Instagram some stuff. What kind of vegetables and fruits we getting today so we can make it so you can heal? Because if you don't eat, you ain't healing. And if you don't heal, you ain't getting up out of here. And we got a plan for you to get up out of here. So it's just, I love what I do and I love being of service. But that one, from the standpoint of boundaries, it changed me. And it changed how I practice medicine, and it changed the positions that I place myself in. Not that I'm not committed to that, but too much of that will cause your edges to fall out. And we have had several bouts of edges coming out and coming back. And so, I have entirely too much hair to have blank spaces. So,
absolutely. So, you know, thinking about all of what we talked about, you know, the unexpected, you know, scenario that you just explained, a lot of the challenges that you've gone through, knowing that you can bring a lot of that wisdom and knowledge and expertise to the Gambia, what do you envision as being the best case scenario, short term and long term, after, you know, all is said and done in the Gambia and we're back home and sort of just thinking about and reflecting about our time there, what do you envision as the best case scenario of positive developments or consequences?
That it's a reciprocal exchange, that I give and I get something. And then whatever it is I get influences how I practice. And then that I go back and I take what it is I learned from them that I implemented and then went back and improved it. Like I'm open to whatever is there and open to serving however I can serve. I'm a blank slate. And so it's my intention to give what it is, whatever it is I have that is a value that can make a difference and learn something in the process and benefit my patients as a consequence. Like plant-based medicine, what y'all do? What y'all know?
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm looking forward to it as well. Dr. Anila, this has been such an inspiring, time that we've spent together. I learned so much about you and the work that you do. I'm just honored to be in your presence and looking forward to working with you, and being with you during this trip in the Gambia.
Ditto. Thank you so very much for having me. I'm excited too.
Yes.
Thank you for listening and for allowing us to be a part of your day. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast to be the first to receive any new episodes as they are released.
Thanks again for listening today. If you'd like to support the Gambia Project, simply go to your browser and type gambiacollaborative.org. That's www.gambiacollaborative.org.
We hope you will join us on the road to the Gambia.
If you enjoyed podcasts like this, you should check out our other shows on Health Podcast Network. For example, Better with Dr. Erica, hosted by Dr. Erica, provides support and guidance in navigating stress-related challenges to transform your relationship to self-care. Each episode arms you with the tools needed to be better, do better, and live better. There was an incredible episode that you should check out called Touch and Connections as Tools for Healing and Better Mental Health. In this episode, her guest breaks down ways to use physical touch as a form of healing for trauma and grief. Check out Better with Dr. Erica on your favorite podcast platform or visit healthpodcastnetwork.com.